Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Capitol Record. I am very excited to bring back on Capitol Record. I think this is our first repeat guest of 2022. And Sam Rhines was on early in 2022, already coming back on. Sam, this is either the biggest compliment I can pay you, or it is a sign of how little people want to come on Capitol Record.
Hopefully it's a compliment.
Yes, no, definitely is. And for those who don't recall, Sam is a senior advisor at Corbu. He has been a economic advisor of quite repute for a long time. I'm proud to call him a friend. I believe that some of his analysis and the work that they do at the macro intelligence firm Corbu is some of the best that I read. And when I say read, I mean devour. And when I say devour, I mean daily, and I'm being very serious. It's not available to the public. This is some of the best strategic and macro intelligence one can find. And Sam has keen insights, as he brought to us earlier in the year, on the United States energy complex. And Sam, a few things have happened in that story since we came on. Next time I bring you on the first week of January and the largest nation on earth is going to declare war on another nation a couple months later, and that nation represents some of the largest export volume of oil and natural gas, I'll make sure I ask you about it a couple months before it happened. How's that sound?
It sounds great.
Look, we saw crude, WTI, hit $125 a barrel. Earlier in March, we saw it come all the way back to the mid-90s, as you and I are sitting here recording. By the time this post, we don't know where it will be. It's funny, isn't it, to think of the mid to high 90s as a new low point. Of course, you know, we were looking at 100 as something to get up to all of last year, and worried about that, not happy about it, right? And now here we are having gone way past that, on the fears of potential cutoff of Russian oil and gas into Europe. I don't want to spoil everything because I really value your opinion more than mine. Where are we in the story of volume, supply, cost, Russia? Give us your take.
Ooh. Well, where to start there?
I know there's a lot there, so take it wherever you want.
Yeah. So I think I'll start with kind of where the U.S. sits, right, and kind of pivot over to Europe after that. One of the more interesting developments over the past several weeks, as you've seen Russia invade Ukraine, has been the general rise in energy prices, but also the lack of reaction that you would have normally seen, or the lack of rhetoric coming out of the oil patch about additional supply, particularly in West Texas. You've seen some action in North Dakota, but not much at all. You know, the old saying that the best cure for high prices is high prices seems to be taking a little bit of a dent here. And part of that is certainly regulations. Another part of that is that we've already seen a lot of the DUCs, the drilled uncompleted wells, already really coming online. That's a story of that's where a lot of the additional capacity, simple, easy, fast turn on capacity, was sitting in the U.S. And we've already seen a lot of those begin to come online. So that's kind of the first point, is we haven't seen the reaction that you would have thought you would have seen. But again, it's only been 3 weeks, right? You went from call it $80 a barrel to almost $130 a barrel and back to $90 a barrel. That's not a conducive environment, believe it or not, to planning ahead for more energy production if you're a producer.
But let me say this. It seems obvious that if you're a producer, you don't want to throw into your pro forma the assumption of sustained 130. But if you do end up going up and down with the down spot being in the 90s, that still tells you something quite significant that is incentivizing to the supply side over, say, something in the 70s.
Oh, certainly. But it's not an instantaneous type reaction, right?
Yeah.
Three weeks is not 3 months. It takes time to bring this on. But that type of volatility is not conducive to bringing up the capital expenditures that you were planning 3 months ago, right? You planned going into 2022. Now all of a sudden, you know, it's somewhat changed. But you've also had a pivot in the oil field that I think is a little understated. And you heard it from Pioneer Resources earlier this month, actually, that they were planning on growing production by 2 to 5% and returning the rest of the capital to shareholders. One of the big things in 2011 to 2014 was that shareholders had asked for was the return of capital. And that is what a lot of U.S. Producers are doing, right? They were delivering on that ask, right? Give us back the cash and, you know, move forward. That is not a trend that is going to easily reverse, right? You're not going to take a lot of that, a lot of the profitability and cash flow and automatically dump it back into production. You will see that return to shareholders continue in a subtle and, I would say, less material uptick in energy production than you would have seen in, call it 2012, 2013, when we had energy prices in the hundreds, right? It's worth remembering that WTI was in the hundreds, and that was during the shale boom, right? It was only when OPEC began to dump a lot of energy, a lot of oil onto the market in 2014 that you really saw energy markets take a dip. That's an understated part of this story is you're going to continue to see a lot of this capital return to shareholders and have it be more of a investor type relationship than it will be a production type relationship.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about why that is. And of course, you've given the kind of landscape around it being the lessons of the past of when there's been booms and bust, the energy sector is tired of being caught in the middle of that, getting whipsawed around. And now this, what you're calling capital return to shareholder orientation, investor relationship. There's also a certain capital discipline associated with it. And some people, most people, I think, mean that as a compliment. Some do not. I see both sides to that, and I want to talk about that. But I do want to point something out, and I just want you to tell me if I'm wrong, because I could be, but it does seem to me you're 100% right, that the volatility on the upside, 90 to 130, 90 to 130, is not the type of volatility that can command the very serious long-term sustainable production decisions, meaning going forward with that. However, when oil went down in 2020, and it was still highly volatile, I'm not going to go to the negative oil price, which we all know was a sort of storage technicality, but nevertheless, even the real market clearing price was bouncing between 20 and 40, 20 and 40, 20 and 40 for a long time. That seemed to be plenty incentivizing to cut the rigs off very quickly. So is it fair to say that downside volatility does produce an immediate reaction and upside volatility stalls a reaction? It seems asymmetrical.
It is somewhat asymmetrical, right? Because there's a big difference between drilling to lose money and drilling to make a little more money, right? So if you're drilling to lose money, that's a big problem. If you're drilling to make a little more money, it's just a little less of an incentive than it was 5 to 7 years ago. So to a degree, yes, it is. It is more asymmetrical than we've seen in the past.
Okay. And then when you talk about this idea of more capital being returned to shareholders, and nevertheless, even the more conservative producers like a Pioneer talking 2 to 5%, there's some going, I think, would like to go higher. Do you believe that the regulatory environment, the green rhetorical environment, AOC, go beat them up in front of Congress, ESG, the kind of public campaign against and the demonization of the fossil industry, is that at play? Or do you think it's purely 2014 to 2020 economics and the kind of hangover effect of saying, sorry, guys, we're not getting suckered into this thing again?
I think it's a little bit of the we're not getting suckered back into this again mentality, but it's also a mentality of scarcity of capital coming in, right? So there's the ESG mentality and that in the bullying is less of an issue in terms of rhetoric and much more of an issue in terms of capital, right?
But why would I have to cut you off? Why would they be so prone to return capital to shareholders if the dynamic impacting production decisions is scarcity of capital?
Well, it's scarcity of investment capital, right? So they've been demanded by their shareholders that have actually stuck around the oil and gas patch to return capital, right? That they need to be capital disciplined. You know, don't just pour all of your resources back into drilling. Give us some returns, because it was a pretty miserable place to be invested for a very long time. And so investors want a return on their investment as well. So the incremental capital that you would normally be able to get on top of that, on top of your cash flow, raising debt, issuing some equity, you just can't really do that much anymore, right? Your shareholders are your shareholders, and it's very difficult to bring new investment into the space. It's private equity has backed away. You have BlackRock backing away. Those are very large pools of capital that simply won't be the incremental dollar into the hole now. And
so
that's problematic.
So you're describing two different dynamics with two different explanations. This is fascinating stuff. One is the investor profile is now very objectively desirous of return of capital through dividends and profitability and free cash flow. And so this capital discipline is forcing them to not reinvest operating cash flow into capital expenditures, thereby becoming really high return on equity players, but nevertheless leaving them capital deprived for growth. And at the same time, the incremental capital that would or could or should be used for such CapEx and growth has been cut off because of ESG and the kind of extrinsic pressures on capital markets from ESG, from political forces, environmental forces, et cetera. Those are two separate, but nevertheless, highly connected dynamics. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's a squeeze from both sides, and that's problematic.
So tell me where I'm wrong, because I actually do think this, but I'm going to pretend I'm playing devil's advocate, even though it's my real opinion. That cutoff of capital that you describe that is problematic is actually a byproduct just as much of the bad returns from 2014 to 2019 or 2020, not merely the political play. And so the political play had the convenient interaction with the time of bad returns, leaving a chicken or egg for us to sit down and analyze now. And that in reality, we don't know if ESG keeps capital out from private equity, from private credit, from hedge funds, let alone public equity and secondary market and Wall Street, because before they could say it was ESG, but for all we know, it's because they were evaporating wealth. And now there's great capital opportunity, and maybe all of a sudden the ESG bullshit goes away.
Yes, exactly. It was interesting, right? In 2014 to 2020, even into 2021, it didn't matter if you weren't invested in energy, right? It was the easiest way to outperform the S&P 500 was just not to own energy in a portfolio, right? That was simple. It was an easy way to light a dollar on fire, was to invest in basically any part of the energy complex, whether it was MLPs, whether it was upstream, whether it was, you know, the more wildcatting side. It was an easy way.
What about the C credits in high yield?
Yeah, exactly. It was just an easy way to evaporate money. Yeah. And so it didn't matter, right? And so ESG got a pretty easy pass because ESG is more weighted towards technology. It's more weighted towards consumer goods and has very little of what was underperforming. So I would say, to your point, we don't really know whether it was the forces of ESG or whether it was the forces of I'm not going to invest there because it doesn't make any sense for my portfolio to be there. I think you're beginning to see that pivot now, particularly in Germany, where they're going to call natural gas and nuclear ESG, or at least proposing to. That pivot has already begun in terms of how we think about ESG moving forward in terms of fossil fuels.
And so perhaps there's light at the end of the tunnel for seeing capital come back in. I love the idea of capital discipline as long as there's ways to fund CapEx for growth, and that's the kind of TBD of this whole story. But again, if the, as you said, and you're exactly right, 2014 to 2020, there were a couple little years in there that were better than others. But the fact of the matter was that ESG had this wonderful convenience on both sides, by the way. What they were avoiding was energy, which was underperforming, and what they were heavy in was technology, which was outperforming. So they got to look good on both sides. You know, ESG, the G stands for governance. So I guess nothing says governance quite like big tech companies with a CEO who gets 100 votes for every one vote his shareholders get or something, but I digress. But now, there was one way to outperform the S&P in 2021, and that was to own energy. And there has been one way to outperform S&P in 2022 so far, as we're coming up here on the end of the first quarter, and that is to own the only sector that right now is a positive return on the quarter, also energy. I just can't believe that that story, it is not possible that this many people are non-economic actors, that they're just extremists and radicals and ideologues. I know there's some real believers out there, but come on, some of these people actually care about a return, right?
Yeah, they do. And that's why you've begun to see some fairly significant flows into the energy space broadly and oil and gas specifically. And frankly, at $90 a barrel, that's not going to change, right? $90 a barrel is highly profitable for most of the industry. There's very little, at least in the U.S. and even the European majors, where $90 is not highly profitable. I mean, you know, ExxonMobil does not model their forward returns at $90 oil. They modeled them, last I checked, at around $50 oil.
And liked what they saw in the model.
And loved what they saw in the model. And the other thing to remember that I think is really interesting is the European and U.S. companies that are selling off some of their properties and, you know, as a, you know, we're reducing our carbon footprint, blah, blah, blah. They're not selling their low-cost stuff. They're selling their high-cost fields, their high-cost incremental barrels. That makes their overall cost structure lower, not higher. So their profitability, their cash flows at current pricing is very, very good. And you know, I do think that you had about a $20 to $30 geopolitical pop in energy prices in early March. You've taken some of that, not all of it, out. I think you probably get into the high 80s before you go back to 100. But those are very, very profitable companies at this level, and that's going to continue to, you know, draw investor interest. That's going to continue to incentivize some people to move back into drilling, whether that's West Texas, whether that's North Dakota, which is profitable at $90 a barrel, or whether it's some of the European majors that still have fields that they can drill and can do it at, you know, $50, $60, $70 a barrel oil. That could be incremental. But also it's one of those where it will draw the ire of the ESG and environmental crowd. But I don't think that's going to matter with $4 a gallon gasoline at the pump.
So let's get geopolitical here. Does something happen out of this Ukraine-Russia lesson whereby Germany, Italy, the key players in Europe, or even the kind of instruction out of Brussels, becomes more open to building terminals to receive LNG? And does something happen out of this that incentivizes a greater American pressure to export LNG? I know we can't flick a switch and make all this happen either on the export or import side, but are we going to see a renaissance? I mean, are we going to see something dramatic that structurally changes in the way that American natural gas is purchased globally?
I hope so. And it appears to be the case, particularly in Germany. You've seen some rumblings there about building additional LNG terminals. which is a tremendous positive and something they have to do. If you're going to wean yourself off of Russian gas and your Europe, you have to build more terminals, and you have to build them, you know, you have to start getting those licenses and getting those plans fairly quickly, right? These trains to export in the US took a long time to build. It's going to take a while to build the import terminals as well. This is not something that's an overnight process, so they have to get cracking on that much sooner rather than later. When it comes, there's also quite a bit of LNG that can come out of Qatar. That's an interesting place, particularly where the Qataris and Japanese recently had a little bit of a breakup over their long-term contracts. So there's some LNG that can come from the Qataris pretty quickly. They also have a large fleet of ships that's ready to move. But the U.S. can ramp up some LNG exports fairly quickly. I mean, it's not a flip the switch, as you said, but we have a lot of natural gas, particularly South Texas, that's ready to be drilled when it's economical. It's very economical if you can get it to Europe right now, and it'll more than likely be highly economical for a very long time if we can put long-term contracts in place at even a moderate price. I mean, $8 to $9 is double what you can get for landlocked nat gas in the U.S., pretty much anywhere.
What are they paying? What are they paying from Russia?
It's difficult to tell, but call it, and because you have to equivalize it, so call it 22, 23 would be kind of the equivalent.
Okay, so for listeners, let's make sure that we have laid this out. Here in the U.S., people can pay $4 to $5 BTU for natty gas. Europe will pay us $8 to $9. Europe will pay Russia $22. Are all three of those numbers reasonably correct?
They're basically correct, yes.
Why? This isn't just an arbitrage. There's some factors at play that are pretty explainable. Why does Europe pay double what we pay? Why does Europe pay more than double for Russian imports than American imports?
Oh, it's simple on a number of levels. One, we do have to ship it, and that's it's expensive to ship. There aren't many ships out there, right? We don't have the capacity.
Where Russia gets to put it through a pipeline.
Exactly. The pipelines are very, very valuable for natural gas.
Okay, but Russia's is more than double our cost, and our shipping is more expensive.
Correct. It's simply a supply-demand issue, right? Yeah. Russia can supply it very, very quickly. We can't, and they can supply a lot more than we can, right? We can't replace a pipeline in any sort of time frame.
So that's what you call pricing power, huh? That Vladimir Putin has.
Yes, it's basically monopoly power. Yeah. We can ship them some LNG. We can't ship them anywhere near enough to replace the natural gas coming through the Nord Stream from Russia, or through Ukraine. We simply are nowhere near that level of capacity at the moment.
No, but we could take steps towards it. And you have one of the largest arbitrages in the history of global economics at your feet to capture. And in doing so, you weaken a geopolitical foe, an evil foe, for those who still have a moral compass. You employ Americans to do it. You aid a democratic ally because Europe becomes de-risked to some point from their energy needs. And so that supply level that we can't meet right now, Midland, Texas, and Corpus Christi, and the partners involved in getting it out of the ground and then into a ship to come east, they think they can meet a lot of that demand. How much could they? If you took 5 years to ramp up and there's no political opposition, do you still need Russia to some degree on the margin?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
I mean, I want listeners to understand how unfair the question I just asked is.
Yes. So this will be mostly speculation.
Yeah.
Eagle Ford Shale is prolific, to say the least. It is gaseous, and it could, with a, call it warp speed, type investment, replace, I would say, some of the overall structure of the market, it would need to also be matched by a warp speed type building of terminals in Europe, right? It's a two-factor problem there. The answer to the question is, can the U.S. drill enough nat gas? Probably. We can probably pull enough nat gas out of the ground. We can probably have enough trains to turn it into LNG and toss it on ships in 5 years. The major question is whether or not Europe will build the terminals to pull it in. I would say it is a possibility. It is a low probability.
Of getting 100% of the delta covered, yeah. But a good portion of it can be, a good yes. portion could be covered short term, but yes. but a pretty fair portion could be covered intermediate term. And that's, I think, yeah. what is got people like you and I scratching our heads as to why we're not jumping on this opportunity. My best guess is that the economics maybe previously were not as compelling. They're now hyper compelling. The environmental argument I'm going to come back to, but the geopolitical point was always potential and not actual, and now it just seems hyper-actual. So the stars are aligning around the economics and the geopolitical. The question then is the environmental. And this is where I just continue to feel that we, and by we I mean people who are pro-energy, pro-America, and pro a more rational solution to this energy dynamic, maybe have failed to make the case. I saw a lot of headlines, Sam, that Italy was ramping up their coal plants in response to supply problems from Russia. What am I missing? Is the LNG export an environmentally weaker solution than coal? Is this the new environmental mantra? Can someone explain this to me, please?
It's just that you can flip on coal pretty much instantly.
Sure. Right.
And you
but can't the environmentalists don't want that.
That's very true. But you can't flip on LNG very quickly. Yep. So I would say that's the major delta, right? Nobody really saw, and by nobody, few people saw the invasion of Ukraine happening and destroying the relationship with Russian natural gas, right? Natural gas was the environmental solution. Russia was fine, you know, whatever, Vladimir Putin, blah. You know, that was the long-term solution for Europe in terms of solving their climate issues, making the environmental lobby happy, et cetera. So they just underinvested in any sort of alternative to Russian natural gas. They do have coal. It's worth remembering that most of that coal also comes from Russia, which is interesting as well.
Doesn't a fair amount come from China?
A fair amount comes from China, but a lot of it actually comes from Russia, too. If you look, particularly when the Germans started flipping on their coal fire plants, a lot of that coal comes from Russia.
Interesting.
It's an interesting dynamic there where, you're trading one scarce resource for another scarce resource from the same place. It's also the other thing that I think is worth noting, and particularly on the oil front, is one of the things that is helping to bring down oil prices in the near term is the notion that India is going to buy 3 million barrels from Russia at a 20 to 25% discount, which is interesting for how much, let's call it, how divisive that has been within the allies against Russia at this point. You still have Europe buying natural gas and other energy products from Russia en masse at the moment. And you have India buying 3 million barrels of oil, and India just takes more and more BS about it than anything I've seen in a very long time. They're paying 25% less for 3 million barrels of oil. I don't see any major problem with that, particularly where Europe hasn't weaned itself off of Russia, et cetera, and they're part of the ally or NATO plus movement against Russia. 3 million barrels at a 20 to 25% discount is helping bring down the overall price of global energy. That is a big ding to the oil price story at the moment. India is a very large importer of oil, so that's been helpful.
But what does that do to India's relationship with Western allies? How has India not become a pariah out of this? I mean, we're all focused on what Beijing is doing with Moscow and Putin. It seems to me India going rogue really hurts the narrative of India being this great future Eastern ally of Western democracies.
Well, I think to a large extent, you know, it's a story of Germany still buying, France is still buying, UK is still buying Russian energy. Why can't India do it too, right? If everybody's still buying the energy front, right? You know, we explicitly made it, call it part of the deal with the European allies that energy was okay to purchase. Then why can't India? I think that's part of the narrative, and they're doing it at a very deep discount. Right, Russia is not benefiting from the pop in energy prices in any meaningful way because of that discount. Right, they are making a fortune off of Europe because Europe has no other alternative for natural gas, so they're paying through the nose for natural gas. But India is paying a very, very steep discount to global energy prices to get oil, right, and secure its future. You also have to remember that India will probably be importing some food as well from Russia. So it'll be interesting to see how that narrative goes. But it's somewhat hypocritical of the U.S. to point at India and go, "You're bad," when Europe's still importing massive amounts of energy from Russia.
Yeah, I guess it's the difference is, it seems to me, Europe is staying par for the course by necessity, where India has elevated the volume opportunistically.
Mm-hmm. And so
there's a political difference.
There's somewhat of a political difference, certainly. And they've elevated their purchases, but they've elevated it in order to get a deep discount. Right. I mean, that needs to be noted, is that they're not paying global energy prices here. They're paying very, very, very steep discounts that I don't think it's going to be a consistent thing. This is not something that, you know, India is going to do for forever. It's something that they're doing on a very opportunistic basis in order to offset some of the other costs. Right. If your food costs are skyrocketing and you have more than a billion people to feed, you've got to offset it somehow, and this is one way to do it. So yes, it's going to be a political football, but I don't think that means that India's somehow pivoting away from the Quad either, right? They're still integrated very well with the U.S. They're still an ally. They're still close with Australia, New Zealand, et cetera.
Got it.
And that's another place to look, by the way, for incremental LNG is Australia. That's been one of the major investment hubs for LNG. So in looking to the allied bloc, Australia is another place that can assist Europe in meeting some of its energy needs as we move forward.
And when we look at where these things shake out, what are we right now, 3 weeks or so into this conflict? Do you think that it really is impossible to handicap where the energy story goes without more clarity on where the military and geopolitical side goes? Or is there starting to be some clarity that one could find where, through the fog of war, there's at least a little visibility into how the economic energy story plays out? Or do you think the two are just going to be highly correlated and therefore volatile along the way?
I think there is some clarity now. I do think, to your point, I do think it's going to be volatile in the near to medium term, right? You're likely to see $80 to $100, $120 oil, highly volatile, headline driven. You know, Russia shuts off Nord Stream to, Russia turns on, Russia pumps, Russia doesn't. You get one headline of a potential peace treaty, you're going to have oil fall. So it's going to be highly volatile as you move through this. But you're in a period of elevated energy prices moving forward because Russia has made itself a pariah. You had the EIA come out, or IEA, come out with their assumption that Russia is going to produce 3 million barrels less per day in the second quarter than they did in the first quarter. That is a 3 million barrel a hit day to the global market. That's something that can't be replaced. Even if OPEC decides to pump, it's not something that can be replaced. Even if there's some Iran deal, that's not going to instantaneously replace it. Even if you have an Iran deal and lower sanctions on Venezuela, not going to replace it. So it's a story of higher energy prices over the medium to longer term. This is not going to be, call it the glory years of the American consumer, seeing $30 to $50 a barrel oil like we did 2015 to 2019. Right? That's not the story anymore. We have underinvested in new production in the U.S., which brought us to, you know, we're still a major producer. We're not underproducing by any stretch, but we're not expanding production either. And you're cutting off one of the major producers of energy from a lot of the world market. So that's going to elevate energy prices as you re-regionalize the global economy. Right? You're going to, you know, Russia's likely to be able to sell to some of its partners, China, for instance, but it's unlikely to be selling at anything other than a discount to the Western world for a very long time.
Well, so it seems to me that there were, in some negative situations for the American energy complex, some occurrences that became permanent. There were lessons learned that got baked in, that after the 2008 severely cyclical downturn, and then, of course, the 2014 moment with OPEC, that the American energy company sectors did not respond by saying, we're going to temporarily change the way we view capital and change the way we view production. But they became sort of structurally different companies around debt ratios, around capital expectations. And I'm wondering if there is a permanent thing that will come in where, again, we've already talked about the capital return and the production capacity and the various complexities around that, but is there the possibility out of this where, regardless of what happens with that Russian supply, the whole world has now seen the potential for what happens when bad actors have more leverage in global supply than good actors do? And do we maybe face, and I've been hyper bullish here, do we maybe face a multi-decade period of people saying, yeah, no matter what happens with the environmental stuff and what happens with cyclical realities around the economy, just as a general rule of thumb, we are going to lean into energy dependence on good actors, not bad actors, going forward. Is that possibly going to get baked in out of this experience?
I think so. I think so. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, we've seen how bad it can go, right? Europe is in a bad place when it comes to energy prices, energy costs. That has been baked into the pie, right? We've seen that really, I would almost say ephemeral, right? It is painful, and it is something that is going to stick around, right? Groceries and gasoline are the two things that voters pay attention to. And when you see a bad actor pushing up the cost of groceries and gasoline, that's a problem. And that's something that people will vote with. So I do think that you're going to begin to see that structural shift to, major energy producers that are highly reliable and the good guys, right? You have, there's a lot of them. We could help Mexico, for instance, has a tremendous amount of oil and gas that could be exploited, but you would need some fairly structural changes there. That's not going to be something that's, call it around the corner, but it is something that is a potential. The U.S., again, huge producer of natural gas, oil, etc. Good actor. Canada, Australia. You have a global energy sphere that could be very, very powerful, particularly as a buffer to some of the Middle Eastern countries and Russia, right? You know, Middle Eastern countries and Russia need some place to sell their oil, right? It's not like this is not something where they can just leave it in the ground, right, and make money off of it. They need to be able to sell it somewhere. And it basically leaves them with China, and that's it. And so they're going to be battling over who gets to supply the most to China and maybe a couple of other Asian countries. And that's lower prices for them unless they decide to come over to the good team. I think that's the structural change that we're likely to see, is the good guys begin to pump oil for themselves and trade amongst themselves, oil, energy, generally, and trade amongst themselves. And that'll bring back some of the actors that decided that maybe it wasn't in their best interest initially to be on the U.S. team. I think it's an interesting dynamic as we move forward.
Well, I think that there is going to be not only interesting things going forward, but perhaps surprising things, in some cases, maybe difficult lessons, in some cases, really exciting things. But Sam, your analysis on all this stuff is very helpful. I know that our listeners appreciate it. I very much appreciate it. And I know it comes through, you know, you're doing a great job here for us today in simplifying some things that are really quite complicated in the midst of a lot of very complicated external circumstances. So thank you for that. And I hope you don't mind if I invite you back again, where as we kind of see how things continue to move in the months ahead.
Oh, would love to come back.
Well, I'll take you up on that. Thank you for listening to another episode of Capitol Record. I'm very pleased to be joined by Samuel Rhines at Corbu. We want the people who believe in free enterprise and who believe in the concept of capital markets, the things that we defend as part of the story of a free society week by week, we want them to understand the particulars that matter right now in various contemporary circumstances. And so that's why subjects like ESG, that's why subjects like global trade, that's why we have put a lot of time into talking about big tech. And then that's why this subject of the energy sector is so important. It's one thing to get the theory right, and I have no interest, by the way, in ever trying to get the practice right until we get the theory. Theory must come before practice. But once we have spent good time in theory, it's really important that we also bring it to practice. And that's what we're doing in our discussion on things like energy, is applying the notions of freedom and the very particular circumstances that matter in a practical macroeconomic sense. And I appreciate the insights that Sam has brought us today. So thank you, as always, for listening to Capitol Record. Please subscribe, forward this podcast, rate us, tell your friends, do everything you can to join the cause of a free and virtuous society.